Anybody else come in the meantime?
Yeah, it's David. Hey, Michael.
Hi, David. Welcome.
Thanks.
There we go. And who else has joined? Anyone else? We all good?
Oh, hi, good morning. It's Herminia.
Herminia, welcome. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
How's it going in Perth?
It's good. The weather is getting better. Thank you.
Ah, good. When you say getting better, you mean cooling down a bit?
Yes.
Yes. Which for most of us is like, we'd be happy to have some of your warmth.
Yeah, we're in autumn now, so we're getting better.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we've been off for 2 weeks. So let's see what's what. Let's check in here and see where you're going. Okay, this is Masterful Provocation Session 4, What and How to Poke, Myths and Beliefs. But before we get on to the topic for today, there is a review here about how you're doing. You've been off for a couple of weeks. What are you doing with respect to this stuff and how it's kind of integrating into your life? And what are you doing to support your own evolution? So fill me in. What's going on out there? This isn't, by the way, a homework question. This isn't the did you do your homework kind of stuff. I'm more curious as to what's been going on in your life as this stuff rolls out through you. What, if anything, have you noticed?
This is Margie. One of the things that I am focusing on doing more of is starting the gap exercise before I coach a client to really help me. What comes up for me is the term clear, like just clear everything. Make it like you meet a clean slate.
Yes.
That's been the biggest thing for me.
Yes. And in the image of having the, going back to the Oracle at Delphi image, the image of the client coming to you and invoking through you the message of the gods, so to speak, the message of the universe, whatever you want to call it, then it is valuable for the mechanism whereby that message is relayed to be as clean and clear as it possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
And then it can come through with its purest essence in some quite surprising ways.
Yeah.
And it might not seem profound internally at the time, but for the other person, it can all of a sudden go wham. And you go, wow, I didn't expect that.
Mm-hmm.
You were about to say something, Marty.
I think along those ways, right with what you're saying, is what I used to do, and until really it got me thinking about it in our last call for this, was there'd be something that a client would say that I felt, would be something that we should get into deeper, yet they weren't done with whatever their point was or whatever they were saying. And one of the other things that really came up for me from class two was, class three, whatever it was, not having to go back, earlier you said, but just allowing it to flow in whatever direction it needs to flow, and then just be that portal where I'm asking questions to allow them to go where they need to go.
Hmm. And sometimes it is appropriate to interrupt the storyline. Because ultimately what we are doing is provoking the cohesion of the storyline, because the storyline in some ways may well be a storyline that has been told and told and told and is creating a circularity for the person, that if we don't interrupt, so to speak, as they say, the pattern interrupt, if we don't interrupt that because something says interrupted at the time, not as a matter of course because I like interrupting people, but just because something in your presence says, wait a minute, I could let this one go, we could circle back to it, but there's something in it that in this moment in time, it's important for me to go boom. And that all happens in a nanosecond.
Yeah, so listening to yourself, really, really listening to those messages that you get at that moment then is what I'm hearing you say.
Yes. Okay. And it's actually, it's listening to the message. As the messenger, we have to listen to the messages.
Mm-hmm.
So if the messenger, despite the potential of being beheaded, if the messenger gets the message that says, interrupt the king,
mm-hmm.
and we don't, we may be missing our job.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense.
Cool, thank you. Who else? What else has been happening out there?
This is Sherry, maybe because I'm also a dietitian. I love practical ideas, and so the thing that I've been using the most is the GAP exercise.
Mm-hmm.
And what spoke to me the most was how you speak about how through silence we hear our thoughts. So I've been noticing the silence more with everyday life. And the other two words that keep popping to me all the time are the distinctions between shift and change. And I just keep thinking about that in terms of my own life and when I hear a friend speaking or my attitude. Or those are the pops for me.
Great. So I'm curious about two things minimally. And one is, as you've been noticing the silence more, just in your everyday life, how has that changed your experience of your everyday life?
I get up later. I don't rush around. I don't care if I don't get all my work done.
Mm-hmm.
Last night, my husband thought that I was sick because I actually went to lay on my bed and watch The Bachelor. He goes, "You are sick. You are sick." Because he doesn't want to kiss me. That's the whole, you know, that's why he cares about that. You are. I'm like, no, I'm not. I just am in my bed. I'm watching The Bachelor. And I never, that's the only show I watch, by the way. And and normally I watch it at my computer. You know, like I'm working and then it's there.
Right.
But I'm like, no, I just want to be present. I'm like, I don't know, I'm slowing down. And the other thing that you keep mentioning, or you mentioned the first week, and I keep thinking about it, is it's the year of the snake. So there's something, like, going on, you know?
Yes. It's going to be a bunch of molting.
Yeah, yeah.
A bunch of old skins being shed all over
mm-hmm.
the place. You know, and the interesting thing about shedding a skin is that while we're in that skin, we actually think that's who we are versus it's something we're wearing. You know, we think that skin, that sense of self that we were, is who we are for all time. But there is a who we are that's creating new skins all the time in the sense of a snake and the shedding of the skin. So a lot of the times, you know, we think, you know, as we shed that skin and we're attached to it, you know, that's where a lot of the upset comes for change or
mm-hmm.
shifts, really. So very cool. Thank you. Anyone else have anything to share before we head on down the road?
Hey, it's David.
Yeah.
I've been working with the C technique a little bit,
mm-hmm.
especially on those kind of future anxiety or, you know, frictors, as you had mentioned, what if I'm not a good enough coach or don't ask the right question on you know, dissolving that shitty story that gets in the way of, you know, coaching, really being the portal as the coach. Been practicing that every day along with the GAP and stuff, and it's really, I feel much clearer when I do that, much more open and responsive in the moment.
wonderful. It's interesting that the stories, and we'll get to this when we start to provoke stories, but the stories end of things in the world for us, and especially why the C technique is useful for this, is that we are storytellers by nature. Human beings are stories. Originally, it was the way that things were recorded. But the interesting thing about stories is that they are made up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we have to know. And even if we're simply doing what we would call reporting facts, we're always simply and only reporting it from one vantage point. And there's a really wonderful movie that shows this, about how we tend to jump to conclusions based on the vantage point. And it's called Vantage Point. And it has Randy Quaid in it, and it has Forrest Whitaker and a number of other celebrities in it. But it's a really interesting exercise in noticing what conclusions we draw or someone would draw from a particular vantage point without having the entire hologram accessible. And that's what happens when we make up stuff about the future. We're standing in one spot, and we make it up, not only about what's occurring in our present time around us, but what potentially might be happening down the road. And then we live that movie out, or attempt to. So the C technique is an exquisite piece to take us outside of the story, have us recognize that it is a story, and realize we actually don't have to live out that movie. We don't have to green light it.
Yeah.
Out of infinity of possibilities, it's only one.
Yeah, and it just reminds me of how, you know, the mind, you know, we're basing it on what we know and that past knowledge, trying to project it into the future when we're not there yet and we don't have the information that will be there when we get there.
Yes. And on top of that, we're basing it on a projection of the past. The projection of the future is being based on the information of the past, but the information of the past is inaccurate at best.
Right.
Because it's grounded in the vantage point of perception that created the perspective that we categorize that past in.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, if we simply looked at the past to tell us what might happen in the future, there would never be another invention because it hadn't been before. I know that's a little bit of a mind bender. Okay, so. Pardon?
We'd be falling off the earth because
we'd be falling off the earth. That's right. Again.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so here we go. We're going to keep touching back on these agilities. We're going to look at myths and what beliefs are and aren't. And we're going to take a look at how one can mechanically break those down while recognizing that beliefs and myths are a version of a story. So you'll be able to now, by practice with things like the C technique, use that with your clients as you are helping them dismantle the mechanical construction of it and at the same time address whatever anxiety may be present when they go to dispel a belief. And this is the interesting thing about that. I'll just jump ahead for a moment. You know, beliefs work has been done for decades, two probably at least that I know of. And people keep running into that challenge of people letting go of their beliefs, which, while it's a nice phrase, it's a very difficult thing to do simply from the languaging called let go of your beliefs. It's not like you have a pebble in your hand and you can just drop it. It's got an internal logic system. It's got an identification. It's got emotional connections. And sometimes people's beliefs shift out of an externally generated transformation, you know, kind of like a meteor-level impact in the environment in their own particular world. It's not just an epiphany. It's just like something impacts them that says they can no longer deny that that belief is no longer useful. However, for the most part, it's an enormous challenge for people to move their beliefs. And the C technique is an exquisite tool for that. And I'll talk a little bit more about it when we get there. Okay, so headed down the road. Here's the opening. If nothing's moving for you, you may be caught in a paradigm. Here's the agilities again. And Margie and Sherry, you were articulating this as well. And David, you were also mentioning that this is becoming part of it. Presence. This is the key to evolutionary coaching. The presence that has the recognition, simultaneous recognition, that you are a player in the game, but the game is being played through you. That you are actually the embodiment of an energy and a presence that is informing the moment. And that presence is being called through you for the express purpose of presencing something through someone else. Using your sensing acuity, you can attune to what that is and the direction of it and the nature of it. Using provocative inquiry, as informed by presence, as this is the time, you know, use it here, press button now, and or saying what is. Sometimes it's a message, a reflection, an observation, a perspective. So we're going to keep touching base on these. Baseline experience is the gap, and then we have the two really powerful ones, the C and the core technique, and wait. In the absence of clarity, wait. So, what is a myth? This is interesting. Myth is a traditional story of ostensibly historical events. And it seems to unfold a part of the worldview of a people or explain a practice or a belief or a natural phenomenon. Think about the mythology of the gods, the Greek gods, or actually many of the what we might call primitive gods. They were all created to explain phenomenon that they had no understanding of. So lightning, a natural phenomenon, must have, because it was something that did something, and people associate that there has to be some sort of force behind it, they would assign it to a god. Go, wow, there's a god of lightning. Whether that was Thor, or whether that was Zeus, or whether that was Odin, or whether that was, you know, whatever god you want to call it, that was the god of it. And it's all over the planet. There's 10,000 gods, I believe, in the Japanese culture. It's either Japanese or Chinese. 10,000 gods. You know, so when people didn't understand things on the level of the scientific level that we have now at a certain point in time, there was a mythology created. However, we also tend to create mythology about people and about our lives, and we live through that mythology. The other aspect of mythology is that there's an imaginary component to it, or an unverifiable existence. This is one of those myths that's out there and has been out there. Money brings happiness. Another myth that's in the coaching profession that I like to provoke in my conversation all the time is a myth that people need a coach. It's a myth. It gets perpetuated out there. People have had success long before we got here. People have been having success in their life getting what they want for hundreds of years without the coaching profession. Now, that doesn't mean that there weren't people they were having interactions with that helped them along the way, but the mythology that's being perpetuated out there is that people need a coach in order to succeed or have the life they want. Not accurate. And it's misrepresentative to put it out that way. People can use a coach to accelerate the process. People can absolutely use a coach to have a better time in the process. But do they need us like they need food? Nope. So, what to do with a myth? Well, one can request for evidence or proof. And by the way, some of the other aspects of what to do with a myth are going to be the same as what to do with a belief, and I'll talk about that when I get to the belief section so I don't duplicate. You know, grounded in facts versus perceptions. And this may need to be a repeated request. So there may be somebody who's living out the mythology of all bosses are idiots. You know, an employee's mythology. Or all gamers are socially inept, which is ludicrous, but that's a myth that's out there. Or all gamers are these heavyweight young teenage males in a basement eating Twinkies and popping Cokes and wear big balloon glasses, and that's it. Nope. So you have to check and see if there's evidence of that. You can present evidence that is incontrovertible and in direct opposition to the myth, and you can really inquire into the heart of the matter, something along the lines of, you know, if this myth wasn't true, how would you have to change how you're being in the world? What would you have to give up? And if we don't poke these myths, people will live them out, often to their detriment, because it's simply perpetuating the mythology in the same way that one might, through the placebo effect of voodoo, one might die because somebody has perpetuated a myth about the impact of voodoo on you. And there have been many instances of that. So, any questions while we're playing here in the myth? Any hits or myths? You'll see these are very akin to beliefs, but they do tend to have a heightened sense of scope in one's life. And what is a belief? It's a mental acceptance of a claim as truth, regardless of supporting or contrary empirical evidence. And here it is, beliefs are constructions. You don't have a genetic code for beliefs. And in fact, when you're born into the world, you don't have one. You don't have a single belief in you. It's not a truth. It's not a fact. It's something we build. We sometimes get it embedded in us, conditioned or programmed or trained into us, but it is not a truth. It is a fabrication based on an experience or information collaborating with interpretation, grounded in a perception or a perspective. I don't even know if I could repeat that. I'll probably have to come back to this recording for that. When you're a baby, you don't have a belief. You don't have the word for belief. Now, the challenge in this, aside from how it tends to run our lives, is that we tend to identify with them later on. I am my belief. No, you're not. You picked it up somewhere, or you cobbled it together out of various pieces of input. But it's not who you are. There was a who of you long before your belief came along. But people identify with their belief, which then makes it a challenge. And going to what David was talking about with respect to the anxieties, this is part of the challenge of giving up one's belief, is that people have no idea who they will be without them, which creates a whole lot of uncertainty and anxiety. And this is an interior component of what makes it difficult for people to relinquish the belief. They have no idea what the world would be like, or they fear that it won't turn out well. both are a projection of a future that doesn't exist in this moment in time, hence the see technique. Now, at times, you may have to toggle back and forth if the energy is in the body, a la core technique, because of a past experience related to the belief. But in most cases, people's identifications with beliefs are a projection of what's going to happen if I give this up? It's been a familiar friend for all these years. I may not know how it'll turn out if I give it up, but at least I know this, how it is now. And that's why it's so difficult for people to relinquish their beliefs, because they think their beliefs are who they are. So any thoughts before I proceed?
Yes, Michael.
Hey, Michael. Oh.
Okay, yes, Molly.
I think beliefs sometimes are societal also.
Well, that's part of the being embedded and encoded with them as we grow up.
Yes.
We're given them. We're trained in them. Where people say, this is how it is, etc. So it gets passed down through mythology, right?
Yeah, and then if you don't go along with it, you're the outcast.
Of course, and then there's another belief that says if I'm an outcast, if I actually live in the full expression of my soloness or my uniqueness, I'll die.
Exactly.
Which is part of an historical mythology that was created out of a primitive time when you were with a tribe, and if you were outcast, most likely you would die. So who else? I heard David, and then I see Steve's here. Hi, Steve.
Hi, everybody.
Yeah, Michael.
So, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, so what I'm curious about is, you know, what is a belief and mental, you know, the mental part, but the really, and you're speaking to the encoder embodied part, and there's times where through the language with the client or with myself, it's like there's no shift or change being provoked through the language alone, and I guess thus core dynamics. So, you know,
mm-hmm.
It just makes me think about the beliefs we absorb before we could speak.
Yep.
Around our parents, around those, and sometimes how language, it might, you know, you've tried all you could, and it's not the way. It's just not shifting or provoking.
Yes. However, there are methods to provoke that.
Can you say
and
more?
That's part of the provocation component here that we're looking at in terms of the provoking, not just intellectually.
Yeah.
But to provoke the core dynamic that happened in a pre-verbal conditioning state.
Yeah.
That's actually what a lot of the core dynamics training is about.
Yeah, I mean, I've noticed in doing them how weird it is that things kind of dissolve. You're like, what just happened there? And when, you know, all the rational belief and you know, language play does work very well sometimes, but with more, let's say, some of my clients that are more you know, they have a lot of anxiety
mm-hmm.
where they like, I rationally know this, but I cannot feel, you know, I cannot feel the shift. I don't feel that, you know, I know that I shouldn't be thinking or believing this, but the mood or the anxiety or feeling state is totally opposite.
Right. And that's the place where you want to go. You don't want to go into the intellect because it's not going to help them.
Absolutely.
It's only useful at certain places when you're looking to dismantle the intellectual construction of a belief
yeah.
long enough as mind candy to give you access to the emotional center
yeah.
of where it's living at source level.
I mean, isn't it just a lot of times better just to go straight there? Or the easy? I mean, if you can do it
yep.
in the conversation quickly, but sometimes it's like, well, why not just go to the
emotional? Absolutely.
Place?
Absolutely. If it's up on the radar screen, and that whatever it is that's challenging this belief, and they've got an emotional energy to it right then and there, go right then and there. Don't wait to keep talking around it.
Yeah.
Now, conditional to doing that is that people have to know that that may be how you play the game, so that they have the appropriate context. You're not, again, diving in without permission.
Yeah. Yep.
So when I do the nine agilities, the masterful agilities work, these core dynamics, the pure awareness techniques, are focused on the provocation and the elements of exactly that kind of interaction.
Mm.
And just going right in, right then and there.
We're going to get to that in this course?
Well, we won't. We're going to get to some of that here. Most of that's okay. In a different course.
Okay.
Yep. So, again, we can play with and begin the construction or deconstruction of a belief, and that will be useful for people. And this is the key thing here. In the having the full presence of the agilities of presence and sensing acuity, you will know whether it's more useful at this moment in time, because timing is everything, at this moment in time, whether or not to go at the simple intellectual deconstruction of the belief and then see what shows up emotionally, or whether or not it is appropriate to go into deliberately provoking an emotion around it. You know, like when someone says, you know, I have this belief that I'll never find, you know, the ideal mate. Now, you can go in and deconstruct that on a mathematical principle of the odds that there's no human being on the planet that with the, you know, the odds against that, etc. You could go ahead and try and track down somebody's history of their perception of that. You could also then go ahead and track down the fact that there are people who have ideal mates in this, in the planet, so the possibility is there, and we're really only talking about this person's frame of whether or not they think they can have one. Or you can provoke it with something akin to, okay, so what if that never happens and you're alone for the rest of your life up to the point where you're dying and you're alone? In most cases, a provocation of that nature is going to trigger an emotion.
Yep.
Not because you're making it be there, because you're pulling back the curtain to reveal that it deep inside, it's already there. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Does that register for others on the call?
100%.
Yeah. Because if we don't help people absence that kind of stuff, they're going to be a prisoner to the belief. Even though they might intellectually change it, they're going to wonder why the law of attraction didn't happen.
Oh.
I keep affirming my thoughts every day. Yeah, but you have an underlying program. Cool.
Yeah,
any other... thank you, David. Great provocation for conversation there. Any other comments or thoughts or questions?
This is Aminia.
Yes.
Two questions. Beliefs can be... that there is a conscious and unconscious choice involved in belief. And the severity of the belief would also be embedded with the culture and the stubbornness to hang on to that belief.
Well, yes, and that stubbornness to hang on, especially if it's culture-driven, is related to the fear of being isolated, again, from the tribe. If I go against the tribe and the culture I've been raised with, who am I without that culture? I could be isolated. And isolation, almost epigenetically, meaning something that rides in on the genes, isolation is tantamount to death for most cultures. That's why banishment was such a horrible punishment for people. You didn't have to kill them. All you had to do was kick them outside the walls of the town and eventually let nature take over. So culture can be a very strong belief component. And this is the interesting thing about beliefs. Beliefs are a function of what a man I heard talk about it recently is patternicity. There's two really strong components in human beings. One is the ability to perceive pattern, whether accurate or not. Meaning sometimes people jump to a conclusion out of three or four elements of what looks like a pattern, and therefore they're drawing a conclusion that X equals Y. And that may not be so. Or they're not perceiving a pattern that is there. And human beings also has, as a survival technique, this whole pattern recognition piece, which would have you recognize patterns of sounds in a jungle around you, patterns of color that don't belong where what you're looking at should have some other colors. So it's part of our biology to recognize patterns, but we don't necessarily do it all that accurately. The second thing, unfortunately, is that human beings are programmed to make meaning of stuff. So we see the pattern and then we make meaning of it. This is part of what grounds cultural beliefs as well as any other beliefs. So we do have a good bit of movement in the background. So if you are going to move, that's fine. You know, nobody needs to sit still. It's not school. But do put your phone on mute. That'll help us. Thank you. So any other questions or comments regarding the beliefs before we move into some deconstruction of these things?
Hi, this is Shirley.
Yes.
The last thing that you said, that we as humans are able to see patterns and then make meaning of them, but the meaning that we make about those patterns are just our interpretations.
Absolutely. And given that we don't see patterns accurately all the time, what does that tell you about this interpretation that we're making about a pattern we may have misperceived? And then we're acting as if it's a truth.
Goes back to the story.
Yes, exactly. Goes back to the story. Wow, we're an Earth-centric.
Mm-hmm.
You sail across the ocean, here's the pattern. You see a ship. Everybody sees a ship. It goes out, goes across the ocean, goes past the horizon line. We don't see it anymore. What happened? Sea monster got it. All you have to do is have one giant squid roll up on the beach dead to think that there are sea monsters out there. Because if you have this thing, pattern says there's always a predator for it. Which means if you have this 20-foot squid rolling up on the beach and there's a predator for it, we don't assume it's the top of the food chain. We assume there's something else that eats that. What must that be? And what would it need? And what would it look like in order to deal with this squid? See, it's very simple to create that kind of mythology. Okay, moving on. All beliefs are constructions. This is the essential premise. There's no DNA for a belief. You're not born with a belief. The next part of this, beliefs stay in place because we don't challenge them. If I don't look under the bed, the boogeyman won't get me. The minute you look under the bed, the boogeyman isn't there. Now, this is functional on a lot of practical levels. If I don't look at my bank account, I won't see how much isn't there. If I don't look at my cash flow in my business, I won't see how it's doing. It's doing okay. Really. You know? going back to the statement by Edward de Bono, it's historical continuity that keeps our assumptions in place, not a repeated assessment of their validity. Newtonian physics was kept in place for a long time until somebody challenged it. And now we have quantum physics. Thanks. And now people are going to, and ironically, we tend to gravitate toward trying to keep things permanent and assume that we have the truth of things. Now, quantum physics is the latest version of Newtonian physics, because there may be something outside there that we can't even begin to see yet. We're busy trying to noodle this one out. What if this one is still just another step? We used to think that a molecule was the smallest particle of matter, and then it was an atom, and then we found out about electrons and protons, and then we found out about muons and quarks and gluons. And then we found out about strings, superstrings. You know, we tend to go, oh, we know it as if we knew it for all time. No, we only know it for the time of reference that we have right now. We validate our beliefs by selected evidence. This is just a picture of the, the double slit experiment, wherein people checked, is the motion of an electron the motion of a particle or a wave? Well, contingent on how you go to measure it, it will show up as either. You go to measure it as a particle, shows up as a particle. You go to measure it as a wave, shows up as a wave. Uh-oh. Which is it? What that illuminates for us is that our participation by creating the measurement is actually affecting the reality. How we see things affects the reality. The reality, at least, that we experience. Not the reality as truth, but the one we experience. So, here we go. Oh, before we go into that, anybody have any thoughts or questions or comments you want to talk about what I just spoke about there?
Yeah, this is Margie. You know, what comes up for me from what you were just talking about is, if we have a belief that's very similar to the belief of our client, where regardless of how it's affecting us or how it's affecting them, then how would we be able to remove ourselves from that belief ourselves to be able to be truly provocative to them?
What an exquisite question. Because you get what you're really asking there. You're really asking, how do I get to be so clean and clear and unattached from any and all beliefs I might have while still having them?
Mm-hmm.
And the distinction comes in that I am my beliefs versus I have them. If I think I am them, if I think they're part of who I am, I will be a prisoner to them. However, if I think I have them, and I operate from the belief, so to speak, that beliefs are something I have, then just like when you have a coat on, you can take the coat off. So in the background of what you're really asking there, is how do I really, truly become that portal through which what's required in the moment comes through, and I'm clean and clear enough to not have something I've acquired over the course of time be part of the filter. You know, you'll know whether or not the belief is in the way if you feel like you have to defend it.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's perfect.
Cool. Great question. I love where that question came from. So on the mechanical, intellectual level, here are some of the ways that this is actually a kind of program to dismantle the belief. First, identify it. You can't dismantle anything you haven't identified. Next, provoke the components of the belief. Sometimes a language nuance keeps it stuck. Let me give you an example of it. At one point, I had a belief that all people in the world were designed to abandon me. I had excellent amount of evidence of that. And they either emotionally abandoned me or physically abandoned me, or both. So, when I became aware that this was one of the things that was running in my background program, I started to provoke it via the language of it. And so I started to notice that also, are all people, and this is where the nuance of language can help shift it. Are all people designed to abandon me? Well, it does look like all people are designed to abandon me. Well, does that mean that they're all designed to abandon people? No, some people have been around with people for a while. So they're not all designed to abandon all people. Okay, so it's just me. So, well, that's a little centric. Maybe they're actually designed for something else. And the abandonment is my word. Okay. Well, maybe just some people are designed to abandon me. And some people just aren't a good fit. Okay. So it went from all to some. And then I found, quite interestingly, that my world experience started to reflect that. There were some people who were hanging by me longer than others had been before. I went, oh, okay. That's interesting. Curious. Maybe it's not all, maybe it's not most, maybe it's not some, maybe it's a few. Maybe they're not designed to abandon me at all, they're designed for something else. And so I would start to take apart the language of the statement. You know, you could do this, we've seen this done probably, with money. So one of the things is all rich people are selfish a-holes. Okay. Now, one of the easiest ways to provoke that one in terms of dismantling the belief of that is to just ask the question. Have you ever, and you might be thinking, I'm going, have you ever met a rich person who isn't? Maybe they haven't. However, you can go in a different direction. Say, have you ever met a poor person who was an a-hole? Well, yeah. Okay, middle class one? Yep. People in different cultures? Yep. Okay, so it's got nothing to do, being an a-hole, it's got nothing to do with money. It has only to do with whether or not you are one in the first place. Oh. Okay. Now, if this all person, all rich person belief was sitting in there, you could also understand why they would unconsciously sabotage or be part of the program to be unconsciously sabotaging their money efforts. Because guess what? They don't want to become that. So why would they keep going? Why would they try to be more successful? Why would they be more successful in whatever choices of actions or decisions they make? Because they don't want to become like those people they have such disdain for, thinking that they have inaccurately, going back to the mythology and beliefs and how it got created, interpreted the cause and effect relationship. Money equals that. No, it doesn't. It may make it more prominently visible, because we tend to have a culture that celebrates people who are rich or, you know, have a kind of profile, higher profile. However, it doesn't mean they are. So the next one element is to provoke the function of the belief. What does it do for us? How does it serve us? This is tricky because people will go, well, it's not serving me. Somewhere it is. Somewhere it may be serving an old you. Somewhere it may be serving something that looks like it's valuable. somewhere it may be serving keeping a particular other construct in place. If I give that up, I may have to become powerful, and then I may have to become more responsible for the level of impact I have in the world, which means I'm not going to be held accountable, which means I won't be able to slide as easily. Okay. And again, one of the things that's useful in there is having the C technique when that kind of anxiety about what will happen if we relinquish its friendly, quasi-familiar nature. Next parts to dismantle are, what does it do? How do we behave when it's working? What does it do on a physical level for us, a spiritual level, an emotional level, an intellectual level? It's essentially why I have the picture there to remind you, the car taking apart the pieces of it. The car itself doesn't have near as much power. It still has impact because it's taking up space. And it may take up attention and time and energy or whatever. But it doesn't have near as much power when it's taken apart in pieces. And you start to understand what the pieces do. Next, you could require a list of current and historical evidence of the validity of that belief, actual as well as anecdotal, and provoke an experiment of its opposition. Challenge them. Okay? So you keep saying that you're shy. This week I'm going to ask you to go out and do something bold. I'm going to provoke this self-definition that you are shy. This week, do something bold. According to your definition, whatever bold is. And then you debrief that. You can request search for contradictory evidence. You can reference expert testimony. You know, like Copernicus and Galileo. One has to be aware that in the middle of provoking somebody's beliefs, you may well experience the kind of consequences in smaller version than Galileo did, because the church wanted to crucify him for provoking the particular belief of earth-centrism. In fact, had, ironically, not the Pope, who was a friend of his, hidden him on his estate, he would have been. Then you can provoke a field test of the new belief. Act as if the adjusted belief is right and gather new evidence. Now, if you have the expectation that it's going to miraculously, hugely transform after a decade or 2 decades or 3 decades of it being a particular way, it's unrealistic. Or rather, it's unlikely. It might, but what you're looking for is a chink in the armor of that old belief by having this new belief field tested and finding out what small pieces of that actually work. You keep requesting actions contradictory to the belief. You examine the results, almost like a lab scientist. You can have people talk with others who have always held these new beliefs, which is really an interesting phenomenon. You know, if you talk with people, if you've had it hard all your life and it's a struggle to have things happen, and you start to engage with people for whom that's not true, if you can sit through your discomfort of being around that long enough, you'll start to understand that, wow, maybe it's not true. And the other steps are sitting there. Ask for nuances, provoke full implementation, and then check for the optimal expression or function of this new belief. You might not have found it. You might have just found a generic large one, but there may be a more personalized version of this new belief. And here's what you'll come up against. This is what we're talking about, David. You come up against identifications. I am that. Attachments. If I give this up, I'll lose this. And then the unknown. I have no idea what it will be. These will all live on the emotional level. So let me, before we get near the end here, let me ask questions. What's hanging out with you regarding beliefs? Out of this last dismantling part.
There's a lot of steps to go through to totally dismantle a belief.
Yes. Absolutely. And one of the interesting things about that recognition that you just said, and I think it's wonderful, is that we have been blithely just attempting to assail other people's beliefs as part of supporting them into a new place, not realizing how intricately the fabric has been woven together. It's a tight weave. It's got history on its side. It's got emotional connections. It's got internal intellectual and emotional logic. It's got external evidence because of the observer-created reality phenomenon. If we don't attend to all of that, and we just say, oh, yeah, just let go of that money belief, change your belief. Oh, yeah, law of attraction, yeah, that works. I got it. I intellectually get it. Why isn't it moving for me? Well, it actually didn't get there, whatever belief you're trying to change with it, it didn't get there like popping a pill in the first place. It was constructed, built, woven, checked, rechecked, adjusted, new information, new data, new input. So yeah, it's like a car, got lots of moving parts. Does this, by the way, give you all a little bit of a feeling and a sense of understanding about what it is that has been, and historically, either for yourself or for others, so difficult about their beliefs in their systems changing? If you've ever had any frustration in working with a client about their beliefs not shifting and moving, whether it's about performance in a business context, whether about living life in a relationship context, whether it's about a political frame of reference, whether it's about a health issue, whatever it is, now you know what you're up against. Doesn't mean it's not handleable. Any other thoughts or observations? And by the way, every now and again, you can provoke and call down a lightning bolt. That's not for you to determine. Go ahead, say that again.
Sorry. That explains for me why those hypnotherapy sessions didn't work.
Yes, it's because it was layering over top of.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's like why that whole Stuart Smiley SNL thing from years ago.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
nice
the
enough.
Affirmations in the mirror.
Yes, right.
I'm smart.
I'm smart enough, I'm good enough, and gosh darn it, people like me.
People like me, that's it. There's your coaching right there.
There it is, yes. And we think that by intellectually stating it over and over, it's going to land. No, it didn't get put, the opposite didn't get put there on simply an intellectual level in the first place. So how could we possibly expect that it was going to be removable simply by an intellectual challenge? We underestimate the power of the emotions connected to the beliefs. So until we debug that, as Tom Stone is fond of saying, until we debug that, that's why people have, and to go back to the very top of the call, that distinction, they have a change, but they don't have the shift of behavior that makes that change be sustainable organically, effortlessly over time. As a person who took therapy for a triple bypass surgery, intellectually, I knew what it would do. Intellectually, everybody in the room that was in the gym with me knew what we needed to do. Was everybody doing it? Nope. Some people were on the treadmill because their doctor told them to, and intellectually they knew they should. So they were just kind of marking their paces through the treadmill exercise. They actually had to slow me down. I said, I'm not doing this again. I am not going in that place again for this. And a year later, I ran the San Diego 26-mile rock and roll marathon. Would I run it again today? No. So any other thoughts or questions? Hey, Steve, you run into business beliefs all the time in the corporate work that you do. How is this playing with what it is that you run into?
I'm not 100% fully present tonight.
Oh, okay.
My whole body's been through.
49ers fan?
No. I'm just very tired. My body's been through a lot in the last 2 weeks. So.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
Okay.
But.
Sorry to put you on the spot like that.
I'm going to need to replay this.
Okay. I just wanted to check in with you because I know that a lot of the times we're looking at some of these things and it might feel like it's all and just about life coaching and things like that, but it is also about business world as well.
Well, yeah, and beliefs are beliefs can sometimes, they can also be myths.
Yes. Yes, especially in business.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
But myths are true to the one that believes them.
Absolutely. Just like voodoo.
What?
Well, voodoo is true to the person who believes it. So if the voodoo god or somebody casts a curse on somebody, that their life will go badly or that they will die, there have been medical cases where people have.
Oh, okay.
Just because they believe in voodoo and somebody cast a voodoo curse on them. So it's like business voodoo.
Okay, you scared me there for a second. I was wondering if you, like, you know, are poking needles into...
No,
dolls of former clients that you weren't fond of.
No, but I think there might be an app for that.
Michael's going to be busy.
It's called Angry Coach.
Angry Coach.
Comes up with little former client visibles. You can put glasses on them. You can put blonde hair or beards or dress them however. It's a complete product. And then you can put little attributes to it, stubborn client, cheap client.
Very good.
So,
Michael?
Yes.
This is Herminia. Apologies, I have to leave soon, but I have one question or one thing that I'd like to comment on.
Go ahead.
How come a belief, for example, that may not be a belief of one society, that may not be a belief of another, could still affect the other person? And I'll just give you an example. It's like, you know, how in Australia they have a belief that if an indigenous person pointed a bone at a white man,
mm-hmm.
they will die. And
right.
The white man hasn't had any belief of this, and yet they die.
Ah, I would. What I would do is I would question whether or not the white man doesn't have any belief of it.
Okay.
The white man may have just enough doubt or just enough belief that it might happen. See, there's a lot of belief in the primitive culture power in a civilized society simply because we all came from primitive cultures. So there's enough of that belief, there's enough of that mythology that's permeated through the world for people to have just enough of an opening for that belief to come in. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Because I'm sure there's some people who have had a bone pointed at them and they don't die.
Yes.
In the infinity of possibilities, the mathematician in me says that's accurate. So the consequences, and this is the interesting thing about it, the consequences of poking these beliefs at first may look like their world is exploding. Their entire planet is going to doom. Because in some ways, an historical world of who they thought they were and how they thought the world was has been shattered. And yet at the same time, they may well end up like, and in most cases do, end up with that kind of ecstatic leap flying into the air in terms of their spirit and possibilities. So we need to be able to deal with ourselves, to be willing to be that kind of provocateur, as well as be able and capable and willing to deal with the level of upset that we might engender once the world has exploded for them. So here's your game for this week, practice time. What beliefs or myths in your world are you going to challenge? You don't need to articulate that to me now, but I'm challenging you to provoke a belief, especially one that is giving you maybe even as much as a 70% return on your investment in that belief. Because there is another belief out there that's available that you can make up that may give you a 90% or 100% return on the investment in that belief. But as long as you're willing to settle for 70%, as Edward de Bono says, if we don't repeatedly assess the validity, it will stay in place. He also calls that the trap of the good answer. We have an answer that's good and serviceable, so we don't look any further for something that might be extraordinary. So what I would love, and it's not required, but I would love is that after a little bit of time of reflecting on this, if you would all send me an email with the belief or myth you're going to challenge so that I can add my intention that it is that moves for you. Okay? And for those of you who don't, for whom that's not a fit as an exercise, that's fine. Like I said, it's not a requirement. So, as we close here, what I'd like to do is find out from you what was useful and what are you going to actually put in play, not just intellectually go, oh, yeah, that was a nice idea. I think I'll just put it in the bag of my ideas and next week it'll be bumped out by the next nice idea. What are you going to put in play this week? And notice how the language of that. I didn't say, what are you going to suffer over? What are you going to put in play?
This is Shirley. What I'm going to put into play is just a context of coming from inquiry and questioning my beliefs and checking in, you know, is this true? Is this really true? Or have I just made all of this up, and so on and so forth?
Well, for all of them, we have made them all up.
Yes.
None of them are ultimately true. The value in questioning it is whether or not it's really serving you in the way that you really want to be served. Is it giving you a great ROI? You know, it's not for me to say that somebody's belief, whatever it is a bad belief to have. My job is to provoke whether or not it's giving you the best ROI you could get on a belief of that caliber, of that nature. If it isn't, and you don't question it, you wouldn't know. So, yeah, I love that. Is it true? Is it really true? Who else?
Well, this is Margie. I think I'm right along with Shirley, is really looking at the beliefs that I just, you know, go along with and take for granted and start challenging them to see how they're serving me or if they're serving me.
Yes. And to what capacity? And is it giving you the full ROI? It might be giving you a good return on the investment intellectually, but it might be beating your physical to death. Or is it giving you a great physical, but it might be kicking your emotions all over the place? Or your finances, or your spirit? Anyone else? What would you like to say or share or talk about what you want to put into play this week? Don't worry, I'm not going to call you on it next week. Everybody's adults here. I don't need to manage your progress and accountability.
This is David. I want to acknowledge and say thank you for some relief about how intricate and difficult it can be to go against some of these beliefs. Sometimes when I feel like, I'm just a terrible coach, maybe that's true, but maybe I'm really into something that's much more difficult than I knew. And through this, it really hit me as a coach sometimes of the story I have of my client, and I'd like to provoke and challenge that this week with my clients for me, of how have I put them in a particular story of who they are and bought into maybe some of what their story, but more than that, my picture of their story, my picture of them, and loosen that up and poke around and see what happens.
Great idea. What story am I putting my client into? And then what am I making up out of putting them into that story? Wonderful inquiry. Anyone else?
This is Sherry. I'd be in Minnesota and Minneapolis. I love the picture of removing beliefs and taking your coat off. So I am going to run around naked this week.
I can hear a new program coming called Butt Naked Beliefs.
Just an idea.
That's great. Anyone else before we close? cool. I want to share with you all that my new website is going up this week. Should be up by Friday. It was the process of challenging my beliefs. And one of my beliefs was, or my perceptions, it might have been a belief, I don't know, was that that nobody in a commercial world would really get me, get who I was. Mm-hmm. Now, you can see what that would do. Every time I got a vendor, and especially with a website and design and the whole SEO thing and all that sort of stuff, that nobody would really get me. What would that, just briefly here at the very end, what would that mean would have to happen, or would most likely happen?
What would most likely happen with that belief?
Yes.
You'd attract all those web developers that you really don't want.
Exactly. That's one. Good. What else?
Keep the same website.
I would have to, or I would have to be the guy who came up with how it got done.
Yeah.
Which meant I would have to learn all that stuff. Ugh.
Yeah.
And you don't like technology, going through all of that.
I don't like going through that much technology.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. You know? How wonderful it was to be wrong. And you'll see it.
Oh, wow. When's it going to launch? What day?
Friday, it looks like.
Okay, great. Great.
Yep. Yep. And I just look at it and I went, oh, my God. And to be wrong in that somebody wouldn't be able to help me with copy because my copy is so personal to me and my colors and my design sense and all that. Oh, God. It would always mean that I would never be able to take advantage of somebody who spent their life or their attention or even the last decade gaining a certain level of expertise. I would always be relegated to living from the land of the amateur trying to get my own stuff done.
Yeah.
How wonderful it is. So when you see it on Friday, if you feel like this, what I'm interested in is what your experience of it is.
Mm.
Not what you think about it, you know, but what's your experience of it? That's what I'm curious
about.
How
long did it take to complete from the moment you found this person to Friday?
November.
Oh, okay.
November of last year.
Yeah.
Oh, and it's not one person. It's a team.
Oh, cool.
Oh, yeah. Yes, it's a company called Prime Concepts that was created by a man named Ford Sachs, who's also a speaker, which meant he also got me from that point of view as well. But he's put together a great team. And there were things I had to clarify and all that sort of stuff along the way. But it's a quite wonderful experience. Which also then, you know, goes back to, and by the way, I do really love this question. What if I'm wrong about that? I think it's going to be one of my favorite questions. What if I'm wrong about that? Because take a look at everything that you limit yourself with. This is a wonderful, provocative question. What if I'm wrong? Now, we usually do that about what if I'm wrong, what if I'm going to make a mistake? But what if I'm wrong about that? I can't have a website that generates $100,000 in 2 weeks. What if I'm wrong? What if I'm wrong that I can't become a national speaker, an international speaker, and on the cover of Time for my concepts and ideas? What if I'm wrong? We usually go, what if I'm wrong when something bad is going to happen? But do we ever challenge it and go, what if I'm wrong that I can't be that clear, that powerful, that incisive with my questions, that masterful with my communication, that provocative? What if I'm wrong about that? What if I'm wrong about my limitation? So I just offered that here at the close. It just sort of showed up. Have a great week, y'all. And we'll see you next week, ready to play.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye, everyone. Bye.